Imagine for a second that you own a piece of a company, just a like a really small piece.
Right, just a few shares.
Yeah, exactly. And tomorrow, that company's flagship product goes completely rogue. I mean, it causes $1 billion in property damage, and the company is instantly forced into bankruptcy.
Just totally wiped out overnight.
Wiped out. The victim's lawyers are out for blood, and the company's bank accounts are totally empty. So you are an owner, right?
Technically, yes.
Can those lawyers come after your personal savings? Can they force the sale of your house to pay that $1 billion settlement?
It's a terrifying thought.
It really is. Welcome to the deep dive. But before we get into the answer to that nightmare hypothetical, just a really quick note. This deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel.
Which is awesome.
It is. If you're prepping for the Series 65, they have a full course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. It is genuinely a game changer for test prep. You can check it out at certfuel.com.
Highly recommend it.
Yeah, so okay, let's unpack this. Today, we have a very specific mission. We are taking on equity securities for the Series 65 exam.
Which is honestly a totally crucial unit. Like, if you look at the architectural breakdown of the Series 65, the equity securities section is going to account for about five questions,
Right.
which translates to roughly 4% of your total score.
Yeah.
And I know 4% might not sound like a massive chunk of real estate at first glance, but
It's the foundation.
exactly. These are the fundamental building blocks of finance. If you don't deeply understand how equity securities function mechanically, you are going to struggle immensely when we get to portfolio management or client recommendations and assessing risk tolerance later on.
Oh, absolutely. And you are 100% going to see these concepts tested. But here is our philosophy for this deep dive. We are completely throwing out the standard dry textbook lectures.
Good riddance.
Yeah. And please, whatever you do, do not rely on rote memorization. It is a massive, massive trap for this specific exam.
A catastrophic trap, honestly. The test writers for the Series 65 are incredibly clever.
So clever.
Like, if you just try to memorize a flashcard that says, preferred stock is sensitive to interest rates, they are going to present you with this convoluted four-paragraph scenario about a client in a shifting macroeconomic
Oh,
environment.
yeah, they love the paragraphs.
Right. And if you don't understand the underlying mechanics of why that sensitivity exists, you will get tripped up. Our goal today is to understand the legal and financial engineering behind these rules. Because if you know the why and you understand who a specific rule benefits, you could just logic your way to the correct answer, no matter how bizarrely they phrase the question.
So to make sure you actually retain this stuff, we are going to break these concepts down using a completely ridiculous yet highly illustrative hypothetical company.
It's pretty absurd, I'm not gonna lie.
It is. But we want these ideas to stick in your brain so vividly that you couldn't forget them even if you tried. So as you listen today, I want to introduce you to our recurring cast of characters.
I love these guys.
Right. First up, we have founder Fiona. So Fiona is this brilliant, highly ambitious, but maybe slightly chaotic CEO who has just launched a brand new startup. We are calling it Fiona's Flying Ferrets.
Which sounds like a high-growth, astronomically high-risk venture capital dream.
Oh, that is exactly what it is. The business model involves strapping little aerodynamic aviator goggles onto ferrets,
Naturally.
naturally, putting them in tiny custom-built gliders and launching them for stadium entertainment.
Please do not ask about the aerodynamics of a ferret.
Do not ask about the logistics, but the venture capitalists are just throwing money at her. So we are going to follow Fiona's corporate journey from her initial stock offering through her international expansion all the way to a potential doomsday scenario.
And we'll use her company to explain literal every single equity concept you need to know.
So let's start at the very bedrock of corporate finance. If you are buying a share of Fiona's Flying Ferrets, you are buying domestic common stock. It is the most basic, fundamental form of equity ownership in a corporation. But we really need to define what the word ownership actually entails here, because it's not what most people think.
No, not at all. Because, I mean, if I buy 10 shares of Ford Motor Company, I can't just walk onto the factory floor and demand they hand me a steering wheel because, I'm a part owner.
Exactly. Or with Fiona, I can't just walk into headquarters and demand to take one of the ferret gliders home. So, what does this equity actually give you legally?
Well, it gives you a proportionate ownership stake in the legal entity of the corporation, which comes with a very specific set of legal rights. But And this is key. It also places you in a very specific and highly vulnerable place in the financial hierarchy of the company.
The hierarchy is everything.
It is. The absolute most defining characteristic of common stock, and this is a core exam concept, so listen up, is that shareholders are what we call residual owners.
Residual owners. Okay, let's ground this with an analogy for you guys listening. I want you to picture the corporate cafeteria at Fiona's Flying Ferrets.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
It's the end of a highly profitable year, and they are throwing a massive, lavish holiday buffet to celebrate. The buffet table is 100 feet long, piled high, with incredible food, but there is a very strict, legally enforced order in which people get to line up and eat.
Yeah, this is what we call the hierarchy of claims.
First in line at this buffet are the secured creditors. These are the banks that gave Fiona loans backed by actual physical collateral.
Like maybe the mortgage on the ferret training facility.
Exactly. They walk right up to the carving station, they take the prime rib, the lobster tails, whatever they want. Next up are the unsecured creditors and the bondholders. They don't have collateral, but they have a legal contract demanding payment.
So they're in line right behind the banks.
Right behind them, and they take the roast chicken, the mashed potatoes, all the good sides. Then you have preferred stockholders, who we will talk about later. They get whatever is left in the chafing dishes, maybe some pasta, a few dinner rolls, a salad.
And then finally, at the absolute back of the line, waiting patiently while literally every single lender, vendor, and preferred investor fills their plates are the common stockholders.
They are the residual owners. They get the residue, the leftovers, the scraps.
Yeah. If there's only a single piece of cold, steamed broccoli left in the pan after all the debts are paid, that's what the common stockholder gets.
If a company liquidates, they're the absolute last in line to receive any assets. They're the most junior security in the entire capital structure.
So let me push this back on you then. If you are legally guaranteed to be at the very back of the line, why on earth would anyone ever want to buy common stock?
That's the million-dollar question.
Right. Why subject your capital to that kind of risk? Why not just be a secured creditor, hold the mortgage, and guarantee you get the prime rib?
Because of the massive asymmetry of the trade-off. Yes, you are last in line if things go wrong. But what if things go incredibly historically right?
Which is the dream.
That's the dream. Let's say Fiona's Flying Ferrets goes completely viral. Suddenly, every major sports stadium in America wants a Flying Ferret halftime show. Then the military wants to use the gliders for reconnaissance.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The company is generating billions in cash. If you own a bond, if you are a creditor, your return is strictly capped by your contract. The company owes you your 5% interest and your principal back, and not a single penny more. You get your prime rib, but you don't get a second helping.
No matter how successful they are.
Exactly. But if you own common stock, there is absolutely no cap on how high that stock price can go. The residual claim is a double-edged sword. You get the leftovers, but if the feast is infinitely massive, the leftovers make you a billionaire.
That unlimited upside is the engine of the entire stock market. But that unlimited upside has to be paired with another crucial legal concept. Which brings us right back to that hypothetical scenario you opened the show with.
Oh, yeah, the lawsuit.
The Series 65 love to test the concept of limited liability.
This is a classic exam gotcha. So let's go back to that opening question. I want you to really think about this logic. Let's say you bought 10 shares of Fiona's Flying Ferrets. It cost you $100. A few months later, an absolute disaster strikes. One of the ferrets goes rogue during a demonstration, veers off course, and crashes right into the mayor's face.
Oh, no, not the mayor.
Yes, the mayor. And he is furious. He's permanently scarred. He sues Fiona's Flying Ferrets for $1 billion. Now, Fiona's company is a startup. They only have about $50,000 in the bank.
So they can't pay.
They cannot pay. So the mayor's lawyers realize the company can't pay the judgment, and they start looking at the individual owners of the company to satisfy the debt. You are an owner. Can the mayor's legal team pierce through the company and seize your personal bank account, your car, or your house to satisfy that billion-dollar lawsuit? I'm going to pause for a second. How would you logic your way through that?
Well, I mean, if you approach it purely from the perspective of a sole proprietorship or a general partnership, you might think, you know, well, if I own the business and the business owes money, I owe the money.
But the answer here is an absolute, definitive, legally bulletproof NO.
And that is the magic of the corporate structure. That is limited liability. The maximum amount of money you can ever lose as a common stockholder is the total amount you initially invested.
That $100.
Exactly. If you bought those shares for $100, the absolute worst-case doomsday scenario is that those shares go to zero. They become worthless paper, and you lose that $100. You cannot, under any circumstances, be held personally liable for the debts, the lawsuits, or the operational obligations of the corporation.
So the downside is strictly mathematically capped at your initial investment, while the upside remains theoretically infinite.
Yep. The test writers will try to trick you here, I promise you. They will write a terrifying paragraph about a company going massively bankrupt, defaulting on $100 million in loans, and they will ask what the shareholders' maximum liability is.
Do not let the big number scare you.
Exactly. Just remember, limited liability. Your personal assets are walled off behind the corporate veil.
This legal protection is historically what allowed modern financial markets to flourish in the first place. I mean, without limited liability, no rational person would ever buy a single share of a company they didn't personally oversee, because the risk of personal ruin would just be way too high.
Right.
So we've established the financial reality of common stock residual claims in bankruptcy, unlimited upside in success, and limited liability protecting your personal assets. But being an owner isn't just about the financial metrics. It is about control. Common stockholders possess a very specific bundle of legal rights.
And we really need to explore exactly how those rights function mechanically, because the exam won't just ask, do they have rights? It will ask how those rights are actually executed. Let's walk through the bundle.
Okay, let's start with some of the more administrative rights. Common stockholders have the right to inspect corporate books and records.
Now, in practice, this doesn't mean you can demand to see the CEO's daily calendar or, like, individual employee payroll. Usually, just receiving the audited annual financial report satisfies this legal requirement for public companies.
Right. They also have the right to freely transfer their shares. This means you can sell them on an exchange, give them to your kids, or leave them in your will, and you do not need Fiona's permission to do so. The shares are your personal property.
Okay, those are straightforward. But then there are preemptive rights. This is a massive concept. It's also known as the anti-dilution provision. Why is this so critical to understand?
Because it protects the proportionate control of early investors.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to imagine the math here. Let's say you were one of Fiona's earliest believers. You bought 1,000 shares when the company only had 10,000 shares total in existence. That means you own exactly 10% of the entire corporation.
That's a huge chunk.
You have a loud voice. You get 10% of any dividends declared. Fast forward a year. Fiona's ferrets are a massive hit, and she wants to raise a ton of capital to build a new training facility in Texas. To raise that money, the board decides they're going to issue and sell 90,000 brand new shares to the public.
So the total number of shares in the world is about to jump from 10,000 to 100,000.
Exactly. If Fiona just dumps those new shares onto the open market and lets random people buy them, your ownership is instantly diluted. You still own your original 1,000 shares, but now it's 1,000 out of 100,000 total shares.
Ouch.
Yeah. Your ownership stake just plummeted from 10% down to 1%. Your voting power was crushed, and your claim on future earnings was totally decimated.
Preemptive rights prevent that stealth wealth transfer. If the company's charter includes preemptive rights, Fiona is legally required to come to you first before she offers those new shares to Wall Street.
Right.
She has to say, hey, we are issuing 90,000 new shares. Since you currently own 10% of the company, you have the right of first refusal to buy 10% of these new shares, so 9,000 shares at a set price.
Now, you don't have to buy them. If you don't have the cash, you can let the rights expire or sometimes even sell the rights themselves. But it guarantees you the opportunity to maintain your exact 10% proportionate ownership.
Now, a very subtle but vital detail from the source material that could be an exam distractor. Preemptive rights are not an automatic universal law for every single corporation in America.
Oh, that's a great point.
Yeah, this right only exists if it is explicitly written into the company's articles of incorporation or corporate charter.
Yeah.
But when asked conceptually on the test what protects an investor from dilution, preemptive rights is your answer.
Okay, let's circle back to the most visible right of a common stockholder, which is voting rights. The exam doesn't just want to know that you can vote. The Series 65 gets deeply granular about how the mathematics of corporate voting work. And to explain this, we need to bring in our next character.
Yes. Let's introduce minority shareholder Mike.
Mike is an incredibly enthusiastic guy. He loves the ferret glider concept. But he doesn't have deep pockets. He scraped together enough money to buy exactly 100 shares of Fiona's Flying Ferrets.
Or him.
He's proud of it. But he is a tiny fish in a very big pond, because on the other side of town, there is a massive institutional hedge fund that holds 10,000 shares. So Mike is unequivocally a minority shareholder.
And it is currently election season at Fiona's Flying Ferrets. At the annual shareholder meeting, there are three open seats on the board of directors that need to be filled. Seat A, seat B, and seat C.
The exam is going to relentlessly test your knowledge of two completely different voting methodologies. Statutory voting, which is sometimes called regular voting, and cumulative voting.
You have to understand the mechanics of both. But the holy grail for the exam is knowing who benefits from each system.
Right.
Let's dive into statutory voting first. How does the math actually work?
In a statutory voting system, the rules are rigid. You get one vote per share, and you must apply them separately to each individual director seat. You cannot cross-pollinate. You cannot shift your votes around. You have to cast a discrete ballot for seat A, a separate discrete ballot for seat B, and a separate one for seat C.
Let's run Mike's math on this.
Yeah.
Mike has 100 shares. There are three open seats. Under statutory voting, Mike is basically handed three separate buckets. He gets 100 votes to put in the bucket for seat A. He gets a completely separate bucket of 100 votes for seat B, and a third separate bucket of 100 votes for seat C.
He cannot take the votes he was given for seat B and dump them into seat A. The buckets are strictly partitioned.
Now, play that out in a contested election. Think about what happens when minority shareholder Mike goes head-to-head against that massive hedge fund holding 10,000 shares.
Oh, it is an absolute massacre. They call the vote for seat A. Mike stands up and proudly casts his 100 votes for his favorite candidate, a guy named Ferret-Loving Fred. The hedge fund manager yawns, stands up, and casts 10,000 votes for some ruthless corporate raider. Fred gets crushed. Mike loses.
Brutal.
Then they move to seat B. Mike again casts his 100 partition votes. The hedge fund casts 10,000 votes. Mike loses again. Same exact story for seat C.
Right.
Mike gets completely and utterly shut out of the boardroom. His 100 shares essentially give him zero voice, because the majority shareholder can simply outmuscle him on every single individual isolated seat.
Which brings us to the core exam rule. Statutory voting mathematically ensures that whoever holds the majority of the shares controls 100% of the board seats. Therefore, statutory voting always benefits the majority shareholders.
But wait, that seems incredibly unfair to Mike. Why would he even bother showing up? If I'm Mike, I'm demanding a different system. Enter cumulative voting. This is where the mechanics flip and things get extremely strategic for the little guy.
Under a cumulative voting framework, those rigid partitions are destroyed. The math changes completely. You calculate your voting power by taking your total number of shares and multiplying it by the total number of open seats.
Okay, total shares times total seats.
Right. That resulting number becomes one giant fluid pool of votes, and you can allocate them however you see fit. You can spread them evenly, or you can take every single vote and concentrate them entirely on one single candidate.
I want you to picture this. Let's run Mike's math under this new cumulative system. Mike has 100 shares. There are three open board seats. 100 shares multiplied by three seats equals a total war chest of 300 votes.
He's got 300 to play with.
Exactly. Now, Mike is smart. He knows he can't beat the hedge fund across the board. So he looks at the ballot and says, you know what? I concede seat B. I concede seat C. I'm going to take all 300 of my total cumulative votes and I'm going to dump every single one of them onto Ferret-Loving Fred for seat A.
And by concentrating his firepower, Mike creates a massive mathematical hurdle for the hedge fund. The hedge fund has 30,000 total votes, 10,000 shares times three, but they have to spread them out if they want to win all three seats.
Right.
If they don't do the math perfectly, Mike's concentrated 300 votes on a single candidate might actually outnumber the fraction of votes the hedge fund allocated to that specific seat. It significantly increases the mathematical probability that Mike can secure at least one seat on the board, ensuring that the minority shareholders have at least a toehold in the boardroom.
Listen to me closely. This is a massive exam trap. We want you to burn this into your prefrontal cortex. Mm. The Series 65 is going to present a scenario describing a small retail investor who is desperate to get some representation on a hostile corporate board. The question will ask which voting method gives this investor the best possible chance of success.
The answer is always, invariably, cumulative voting. Why? Because cumulative voting benefits the minority shareholder by allowing them to pool and concentrate their votes.
Let's repeat the mantra. Statutory benefits the majority. Cumulative benefits the minority.
And while we're discussing the logistics of voting, we should briefly touch on how these votes are actually cast in the real world. The source outline specifically notes that proxy voting is regulated by the SEC under the Securities Exchange Act of 1934.
Right, because let's be real, Mike lives in Ohio, and Fiona's Flying Ferrets is probably incorporated in Delaware. Mike is not going to spend $500 on a plane ticket to fly to Delaware just to cast his 300 cumulative votes in person at a Tuesday morning shareholder meeting. So he uses a proxy.
A proxy is essentially a legally binding absentee ballot. It is a written authorization that Mike signs, which legally empowers someone else, usually the company's management, or a designated representative, to physically cast his votes at the meeting on his behalf, strictly according to the instructions he checked off on the proxy card.
Now, why does the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 care so much about this? Why is it heavily regulated?
Because before strict regulations, proxy solicitation was rife with fraud. Management teams would send out incredibly misleading proxy materials, tricking retail investors into signing over their voting rights, allowing corrupt boards to entrench themselves or approve terrible mergers.
Yikes.
The 1934 Act requires all proxy materials to be filed with the SEC, ensuring they contain full, fair, and honest disclosures about exactly what the shareholders are voting on. If a billionaire activist investor like a Carl Icahn type wants to take over Fiona's board, he will launch a proxy fight, mailing his own regulated materials to shareholders, trying to convince them to sign their proxy rights over to him instead of to Fiona.
It's corporate warfare via absentee ballot. Okay, we have one final fundamental right of common stockholders to dissect, and it's another massive area where the exam tries to bait you into a wrong answer, the right to receive dividends.
I want you to ask the listener another logic question to test their instincts on this one.
Okay, let's put you on the spot. Think about our guy, Mike. He owns his 100 shares of common stock. It's the end of Q4. Fiona's company just released their earnings report, and it is a blockbuster. The ferret gliders are sold out nationwide. The company just posted a record-breaking $10 million in pure net profit. The bank accounts are literally overflowing. Based purely on the fact that Mike is a part owner of this incredibly profitable company, does Fiona's Flying Ferrets have a legal obligation to write Mike a check and pay him a cash dividend? I'll let you think through the mechanics of that.
It's tricky because if you're looking at it purely from an intuitive standpoint, if you own a profitable pizza shop, you take some of the profits out of the register at the end of the week.
Right, but this is a corporation, and the answer to the question is no, absolutely, unequivocally not.
This is a fundamental tenet of corporate finance. Common stock dividends are never, ever legally guaranteed. The board of directors, the people Mike was just trying to vote for, possess total unmitigated discretion over what happens to that $10 million.
They might sit in the boardroom, look at that massive pile of cash, and say, you know what, we could pay a dollar per share dividend out to Mike in the hedge fund OR. We could take that entire $10 million and sink it into research and development to build a supersonic, jet-propelled ferret glider.
Which sounds dangerous.
Very. But if the board chooses to reinvest the money back into the business for future growth, Mike does not get a single dime in cash dividends. And he can't sue them for it.
Now, Mike isn't necessarily unhappy about this. If that supersonic glider is a success, the overall value of the company explodes, and the price of his shares on the stock market goes up. He benefits from capital appreciation.
Exactly.
This is exactly how companies like Amazon operated for decades. They generated massive cash flow, but paid zero dividends, choosing instead to reinvest every penny to dominate global logistics. But the testable point remains. The cash dividend itself is a discretionary choice, not a contractual right.
If the Series 65 asks you to identify which security guarantees a dividend, do not fall for the trap and tick common stock. The legal right is strictly defined as the right to receive a proportionate share of a dividend only if and when the board of directors formally declares one.
That covers the domestic landscape. But Fiona is an incredibly ambitious CEO. The U.S. market is saturated. She's looking at the map. And she decides she's not satisfied.
She is going global. Imagine Fiona opens a massive European subsidiary headquartered in Paris, the Ferret Volant de Fiona.
Very fancy.
We are now moving away from domestic equities and diving into foreign common stock. Let's say you, as a U.S.-based investor, see the European launch and you want to get in on this action. But the moment you step outside the jurisdictional borders of the United States, you are introducing entirely new layers of risk that the Series 65 expects you to be able to identify and navigate.
Direct foreign investment means you are buying shares of a company that is legally incorporated outside the U.S. This usually means the shares trade on a foreign stock exchange like the Euronext in Paris. And critically, they are priced in a foreign currency.
Let's start with the macro threats. When you invest in a domestic U.S. company, you generally have a deep, implicit trust in the legal and political framework. If the U.S. government tries to seize Fiona's factory in Texas, she can take them to federal court. But what happens if you invest in an emerging market or a country with a historically unstable regime? This is what the exam calls political risk or sovereign risk.
Exactly. When you cross a border, you are subjecting your capital to the whims of a foreign government. A new political regime could sweep into power and decide that Ferret Aviation is a matter of national security.
Which it might be.
Right. They could literally nationalize the industry, expropriating the company's assets without fair compensation. Think about historical parallels, like when foreign oil or mining operations were abruptly nationalized by sovereign governments in South America or the Middle East. The investors were completely wiped out by political decree.
Wow.
Alternatively, a government might suddenly impose draconian capital controls, making it legally impossible for you to convert your profits and move your money out of their banking system.
Yeah.
That is sovereign risk, the constant danger that foreign governmental actions will unilaterally destroy your investment.
And speaking of governments wanting a piece of your money, let's talk about taxes. The outline explicitly highlights foreign tax withholding. The exam writers love testing the mechanics of this. Let's say Fiona's Paris operation is hugely profitable and the French board of directors actually declares a dividend. They send the equivalent of $100 to you here in America. But before that money ever crosses the Atlantic Ocean, the French government steps in and takes a slice, say 15%, as a withholding tax.
Which, on its face, seems infuriatingly unfair to a U.S. investor. Because you are a U.S. citizen, you are legally obligated to report that exact same $100 dividend income to the IRS on your tax return and pay U.S. income taxes on it. You are getting taxed by two different sovereign nations on the exact same dollar of corporate profit.
If left unresolved, this double taxation would completely stifle international investment. Nobody would ever buy a foreign stock. So the tax code provides a release valve.
To prevent this punitive double taxation, the IRS allows U.S. investors to claim a foreign tax credit on their domestic U.S. tax return. Essentially, you tell the IRS, hey, France already took $15 out of this $100 dividend, and the IRS will generally allow you to reduce your U.S. tax liability by that amount.
That's huge.
It is a highly testable point. If a question asks how an investor mitigates or offsets the negative impact of foreign tax withholding, you are scanning the multiple choice answers for the U.S. foreign tax credit.
Okay, now it's time for a mental pivot. I have another logic test for you, and this one trips up a massive percentage of test takers. Let's say you decide to bypass the U.S. markets completely. You wire money to Europe, you open a foreign brokerage account, and you buy stock directly in Fiona's French subsidiary. The stock trades on the Paris exchange, so it is priced in euros. Over the course of the next 12 months, Fiona's company absolutely crushes earnings. The stock price goes up exactly 20% on the European exchange. You are thrilled. You decide to sell the stock and lock in your profits. Is it mathematically possible that despite the underlying stock surging 20%, you actually lose money taking a net loss when that cash finally lands back in your local U.S. checking account? I want you to think about what happens to the money between Paris and your bank.
It feels like a total paradox. The stock went up, but your account balance went down.
But the answer is yes. Yes, you can absolutely lose money on a winning stock. And understanding why that happens is the absolute key to mastering currency risk, which is also referred to as exchange rate risk on the exam.
Let's walk through the mechanics of the currency conversion. Because you live in America, you buy your groceries in U.S. dollars, and you pay your mortgage in U.S. dollars. Those euros you generated from selling the profitable stock in Paris are useless to you at the local grocery store. They must be converted back into U.S. dollars.
And here's the catch. The value of global currencies relative to one another is not fixed. It fluctuates violently every single second of every trading day in the foreign exchange markets.
Let's run a hypothetical scenario with simple math. Let's say on the day you initially bought the stock, the global currency markets were perfectly balanced. 1 euro was worth exactly 1 US dollar, a perfect 1-to-1 exchange ratio.
But a year goes by, you are ready to sell. The stock is up 20% in euro terms. But over that same year, the macroeconomic landscape shifted. The U.S. Federal Reserve raised interest rates, the American economy boomed, and the U.S. dollar got incredibly, historically strong on the global stage. It is flexing its muscles. Now, the exchange rate has shifted dramatically. It now takes 2 euros to buy just one single U.S. dollar. Do you see what just happened to your profits? even though your stock investment grew by 20% in terms of the number of euros you hold, when you take that pile of euros to the International Currency Exchange Desk, they are worth half as much in US dollars as they used to be. The overwhelming strength of the US dollar effectively wiped out all of your 20% equity gains and actually drove your overall return into negative territory.
That is currency risk in a nutshell. And the rule of thumb you need to internalize for the exam is this. A strong US dollar hurts your foreign investment returns when you bring the money home. Conversely, a weak US dollar helps your foreign returns, acting as a multiplier.
That makes sense.
The exam will test whether you understand that currency risk operates entirely independently of the underlying company's actual business performance. Fiona's French company can execute their business model perfectly, the stock can hit all-time highs in Paris, and a shifting exchange rate can still absolutely ruin your portfolio.
Now, let's be honest. Setting up foreign brokerage accounts, dealing with international wire transfers, constantly calculating real-time exchange rates just to see what your portfolio is worth, it is a massive logistical nightmare for the average retail investor in Ohio. Wall Street recognized that this immense friction was preventing American capital from flowing into foreign companies. So the financial industry engineered a brilliant structural solution, the American Depository Receipt, or ADR.
The ADR is a masterpiece of financial plumbing.
I love the mechanics of ADRs. I want you to think of an ADR as a magic window display. Imagine you are walking down Wall Street and you look in a brokerage window. You see a beautiful display for Fiona's European ferret stock. You can walk right into that domestic U.S. brokerage, buy the stock using your standard U.S. account, pay for it using standard U.S. dollars, and when a dividend is paid, it shows up in your account in U.S. dollars. It feels, acts, and trades exactly like buying a standard American company like Apple or Microsoft.
But it is a carefully constructed illusion. It's a convenience mechanism designed to hide the cross-border friction. What is actually happening behind the scenes is a massive logistical operation. A huge U.S. depository bank, think of a titan like J.P. Morgan or BNY Mellon, has physically gone overseas to the Paris Exchange.
Okay, so they do the heavy lifting.
Right. They have used their institutional capital to buy millions of shares of Fiona's actual French stock. They take those physical shares and they lock them securely inside a vault in a foreign branch of their bank.
They lock up the actual foreign equity, and then they come back to the United States and they issue receipts. These receipts are legally backed by the underlying shares sitting in that Paris vault. Those receipts are the American Depository Receipts, the ADRs. When you buy an ADR on the New York Stock Exchange, you are not directly buying the French company. You are trading the bank's receipts here in America in dollars, while the bank holds the underlying asset overseas.
ADRs are incredibly popular because they completely eliminate the logistical hurdles of direct foreign ownership. You don't need to hire a French broker. You don't need to execute a currency conversion to make the trade. The U.S. Depository Bank handles all the messy administrative work. When Fiona's French company pays a dividend in euros, the Depository Bank collects the euros in Paris, handles the currency conversion into dollars at institutional exchange rates, and passes the dollars directly into your U.S. account.
It sounds perfect, but, and this is a massive distinction you have to know for the exam, not all ADRs are created equal. There is a rigid dividing line between what is called a sponsored ADR and an unsponsored ADR.
Let's put them side by side, because the exam will test the differences in investor protections. Let's start with a sponsored ADR. The key word here is sponsored, meaning the foreign issuer, Fiona, is actively involved in the process. Fiona looks at the U.S. market and says, I want American capital. Let's make this happen. She legally cooperates with the U.S. Depository Bank to create the ADR.
Which means better protection, right?
Exactly. Because there is active issuer involvement, sponsored ADRs offer a much higher tier of regulatory protection for the investor. The ADR is formally registered with the SEC. The company provides regular financial reports translated into English. And crucially, because it meets strict regulatory standards, a sponsored ADR can be officially lifted and traded on major U.S. exchanges, like the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ.
And what about voting rights? We spent an entire segment talking about minority shareholder Mike and how desperate he was to vote. Do you get to vote with an ADR?
With a sponsored ADR, yes. The Depository Bank acts as a transparent pass-through mechanism. They receive the proxy ballot from the French company. They translate it, send it to the U.S. investor. The investor says vote yes on this merger, and the bank faithfully casts that vote on the actual shares sitting in the Paris vault. The U.S. investor retains their corporate voice.
Now, contrast that cooperative environment with an unsponsored ADR. This is a completely different animal. This happens when a U.S. investment bank realizes there is high retail demand for a specific foreign stock, but the foreign company couldn't care less. Fiona is sitting in Paris saying, I am busy building ferrets. I do not want to deal with the SEC. I do not want to translate my accounting to U.S. GAAP standards. Do whatever you want, but leave me out of it. The U.S. bank decides to go ahead and create the ADR anyway, aggressively buying the shares on the open market and issuing receipts without Fiona's help, consent, or cooperation.
Because there is zero issuer cooperation and no SEC registration by the company, unsponsored ADRs are legally prohibited from trading on major exchanges like the NYSE. They are relegated to trading over-the-counter or OTC. They offer significantly lower investor protection. There is no guarantee of SEC-compliant financial reporting. And more often than not, the voting rights do not pass through to the U.S. investor. The bank just keeps the voting power for itself.
So, memorize the dichotomy. Sponsored equals issuer cooperation, major exchange listing, SEC reporting, and retained voting rights. Unsponsored equals rogue bank creation, OTC trading, minimal reporting, and lost voting rights.
Which brings us to the single biggest exam trap in this entire unit. If you zone out for everything else, lock back in right now, because this shows up constantly.
I am going to slow down and emphasize this because I have seen so many smart people get this wrong. ADRs do not eliminate currency risk.
Let me repeat that so it anchors in your mind. Despite all their conveniences, American depository receipts do absolutely nothing to eliminate currency risk.
This is exactly where the Series 65 writers will try to set the trap. The test question will present you with a beautiful, comforting, highly sanitized scenario. It will say, Client X is risk-averse. She buys a sponsored ADR. The ADR trades on the New York Stock Exchange, quoted in U.S. dollars. Every quarter, the dividends are deposited directly into her brokerage account in U.S. dollars. Does Client X have currency risk? And because you see the word dollars explicitly written out twice, your brain desperately wants to say no. You think, she never touched a euro. How can she have exchange rate risk?
Do not let the test trick your logic. You have to trace the money back to the source. Remember the magic window display? Yes, the receipt you are holding trades in dollars on Wall Street. Yes, the final dividend is handed to you in a dollar format. But what about the underlying asset?
Right, the shares in the vault.
Exactly. The actual physical shares generating that wealth are still sitting in a vault in Paris, and their intrinsic value is priced in euros. When Fiona's company declares a dividend, they pay it to the bank in euros. The depository bank then has to take those euros and convert them to dollars before they can give the money to you. If the exchange rate is terrible on the exact day the bank executes that conversion, your dollar dividend shrinks dramatically. The currency risk is permanently baked into the DNA of the underlying asset, and the ADR wrapper cannot magically shield you from global macroeconomic shifts.
ADRs provide logistical convenience. They do not provide a magical force field against exchange rates. Write that down. Keep it in your back pocket for test day.
All right, let's step away from the complexities of the global stage and bring it back home to look at a completely different class of equity. We are pivoting to what I like to call the identity crisis of the financial world.
To explain this properly, we need to introduce our final recurring character. We've met chaotic founder Fiona, and we've met risk-tolerant minority shareholder Mike. Now, I want you to meet conservative Carl.
Carl represents a very specific, very common archetype of investor that you will deal with constantly as a financial advisor.
Yes.
He is fundamentally wired differently than Mike.
Completely differently. Mike thrives on chaos. He is perfectly happy standing at the very back of the buffet line, accepting the residual risk of common stock because he dreams of the unlimited upside. If the company goes under, Mike shrugs it off. Conservative Carl. He has a weak stomach for financial turbulence. He looks at Fiona's flying ferrets and thinks, you know, the business model actually generates great cash flow, but I absolutely hate stock market volatility, I hate uncertainty, and I refuse to stand at the back of the line waiting for leftovers.
He just wants peace of mind.
Exactly. Carl is retired. He just wants steady, reliable, mathematically predictable income to pay his golf club fees. But he still wants to deploy his capital into Fiona's company.
And critically, Fiona's company desperately wants Carl's money to fund their expansion. But Fiona knows she can't sell him common stock. It's too risky for him. And maybe she doesn't want to issue a traditional bond because she doesn't want the rigid legal obligation of debt that could force her into bankruptcy if she misses a payment. So, to bridge the gap and attract conservative investors like Carl, corporations engineered a hybrid security, preferred stock.
Preferred stock is absolutely fascinating because it suffers from a severe structural identity crisis. Legally speaking, it is classified as equity. Carl is officially an owner of the company, not a lender. But functionally, behaviorally, in almost every way that matters to the market, preferred stock acts exactly like debt. It acts like a bond.
To understand exactly what Carl is buying, we need to do a strict side-by-side comparison of common stock versus preferred stock. Let's look at exactly what Carl is trading away to get his safety and what he's getting in return. The first major point of divergence is voting rights.
We spent 20 minutes talking about common stock voting. Mike gets his statutory or cumulative voting. He gets to fight for board seats. Preferred stock, generally speaking, does not vote. Carl legally surrenders his voice in corporate affairs. He doesn't get to vote on the board of directors. He doesn't get to vote on mergers. And the truth is, Carl doesn't care who is running the company as long as his dividend checks clear on time. He trades control for security.
The second and most defining difference is the nature of the dividend itself. Common stock dividends, as we established, are variable, completely unpredictable, and heavily dependent on the board's mood and the company's growth needs. Preferred stock, however, is designed to pay a fixed dividend. It is stated right on the face of the stock certificate as either a fixed dollar amount or, more commonly, a fixed percentage of par value.
Par value. Okay, let's unpack this term because it is a massive point of confusion for students. With common stock, the term par value is essentially an archaic accounting fiction. It might be set at 1 penny per share just to satisfy a state incorporation law. It means literally nothing to the investor analyzing a common stock. But with preferred stock, par value is the most important number on the sheet. It actually dictates the math of the investment.
Precisely. Let's say Carl buys a standard preferred stock from Fiona. The certificate explicitly states it has a par value of $100 and a stated dividend rate of 5%. That means conservative Carl knows with absolute mathematical certainty that this specific share is engineered to pay him exactly $5 every single year. It is simply 5% of that $100 par value.
Makes sense.
And it doesn't matter if the stock is currently trading at $110 or $90 on the open market, the dividend is forever locked to that original $100 par value.
Now, let's play devil's advocate. You said preferred stock is equity, not debt. Does Fiona have to pay Carl that $5 every year? Like, is she legally bound by contract the way she is with a bond interest payment, where missing a payment triggers a default?
No, and that is a vital legal distinction that keeps preferred stock firmly in the equity category. The dividend still technically requires formal declaration by the board of directors. It is not a legally enforceable debt obligation. If Fiona's company hits a massive recession, Ferret Glider sales plummet, and they simply do not have the cash flow, the board can legally choose to skip Carl's preferred dividend to keep the company afloat.
But, and here is the magic word that gives the security its name, priority. Preferred means priority. Let's go back to the buffet line. If the board decides they have enough cash to pay out any dividends whatsoever, they are legally required to pay conservative Carl his entire $5 first, completely in full, before they are allowed to pass a single penny down the line to minority shareholder Mike. Carl skips ahead of the common stockholders.
He gets absolute dividend priority, and as we will detail in the doomsday scenario, he gets liquidation priority as well. He is structurally safer. But remember the trade-off. In exchange for that safety and priority, his growth potential is severely capped. Mike has unlimited upside if the company cures cancer. Mike is a billionaire. Carl just gets his $5 a year forever, no matter how astronomically successful the company becomes.
And because that $5 dividend is a fixed, unchanging cash flow, it completely dictates how the secondary market prices Carl's shares. It strips away the wild speculation of equity and makes the stock highly sensitive to macroeconomic interest rates, behaving exactly like a fixed income bond.
This is perhaps the most fundamental pricing concept for the exam. You must understand that the price of preferred stock has an inverse relationship with prevailing interest rates. They move like a seesaw.
Let's test your logic on this. I'm going to set up a scenario, and I want the listener to think through human behavioral economics. Let's say Carl buys his preferred stock. Par value, $100, paying a 5% fixed dividend. He's getting his $5 a year. Everyone is happy. But over the next 2 years, inflation skyrockets. To combat inflation, the Federal Reserve hikes interest rates dramatically. Market interest rates shoot up to a staggering 10%.
Wow, okay.
Right. Now, Fiona's company needs more cash, so she issues a brand new series of preferred stock. To attract investors in this new high-rate environment, this new stock pays 10% or $10 a year on a $100 par value. Now, Carl suddenly needs cash to fix his roof, so he tries to sell his old 5% stock on the open market. What happens to the price of Carl's old preferred stock? I'll give you a second to think about the psychology of the buyer.
Think about it from the perspective of the person Carl is trying to sell to. Yeah. Why would they buy Carl's asset?
They wouldn't, at least not for $100. Nobody in their right mind is going to hand Carl a full $100 bill for an old certificate that only spits out $5 a year when they can take that exact same $100 bill, call up Fiona's broker, and buy a brand new certificate that spits out $10 a year. Carl's asset is fundamentally less valuable in a high interest rate world.
Therefore, the only way Carl can entice a buyer to take his old shares off his hands is by slashing his asking price. He has to systematically drop the price of his stock, maybe down to $50, until that fixed $5 dividend represents a competitive 10% yield to the new buyer based on their discounted purchase price. The underlying price of his preferred stock must fall to adjust to the new environment.
Right, the seesaw.
Exactly. Conversely, if we reverse this scenario and the Federal Reserve drops interest rates down to 2%, Carl's old 5% stock suddenly looks like an incredibly lucrative gold mine. Investors will bid the price of his shares up well above the $100 par value to get their hands on that high yield.
When interest rates rise, preferred stock prices fall. When interest rates fall, preferred stock prices rise. It is an equity security suffering a debt identity crisis. And this brings us perfectly into the most mathematically complex part of the outline.
We're moving into the yield trade-off principle. Because while we just explained standard straight preferred stock, Wall Street hates simplicity. Corporations rarely just issue plain vanilla preferred stock. They bolt on special contractual features to tweak the risk and reward profile, either to protect the investor or to give the company more flexibility.
If you want to master the variables preferred stock for the Series 65, and you absolutely must, you need to internalize this one golden rule. Do not try to memorize a list of features. Memorize this framework, and everything else flows logically from it.
The golden rule is a simple question you must ask yourself every time you see a preferred stock feature on the exam. Who fundamentally benefits from this specific feature? Does it help the investor, or does it help the issuing corporation?
If the feature makes the investment objectively safer, more profitable, or more flexible for the investor, for conservative Carl, then the company doesn't have to work as hard to sell it to him. Because the feature is so inherently attractive and reduces Carl's risk, the company can get away with offering a lower stated dividend rate, and Carl will still happily buy it.
But if the feature benefits the issuer, if it gives founder Fiona a strategic advantage that actively adds risk, uncertainty, or a cap on returns for conservative Carl, then Carl is not stupid. He is going to demand financial compensation for taking on that extra burden.
Yeah.
Fiona will be forced to offer a significantly higher dividend rate just to convince him to take the deal.
Let me summarize that into a mantra. Investor benefits equal lower yield. Issuer benefits equal higher yield. Let's role play this to prove the concept. Let's apply this golden rule to every single type of preferred stock the exam outline mentions. Let's start with cumulative preferred stock.
Okay, set the scene. Fiona sits down at the negotiating table with Carl. She says, Carl, I want you to buy my preferred stock at a 5% yield. But Carl is skeptical. He says, Fiona, startups are inherently volatile. I know preferred dividends aren't legally guaranteed. What if we hit a recession, the board decides to preserve cash, and you skip my 5% dividend this year? I'm out of luck. He starts to walk away from the table.
Oh, she's losing him.
So Fiona scrambles and counters. Wait, what if I make it cumulative preferred? This means if we are forced to skip your dividend this year, it doesn't just disappear into the ether. It legally accumulates on our balance sheet as what we call a dividend in arrears. Next year, if we recover and want to pay any dividends to the common shareholders, we are legally barred from doing so until we pay you last year's missed $5, PLCS this year's $5. All arrears must be cleared before minority shareholder Mike sees a single dime.
Carl stops and thinks about this. This is a massive structural safety net. His dividends pile up as corporate IOUs instead of just evaporating. So apply the golden rule. Who benefits from this cumulative feature? Carl. It aggressively protects the investor's cash flow over the long term.
And what is the result on the yield? Because this feature is so highly desirable and reduces Carl's risk of permanent loss, Fiona doesn't need to offer the full 5% to get him to sign. She can offer it at a lower dividend rate. Maybe she only offers 4.5%. Carl accepts the lower yield because he places a high value on the cumulative protection.
Boom. Logic dictates the answer.
Let's do the next one. Participating preferred. Carl is back at the table. He says, Fiona, I like the safety of my fixed dividend, but I look over at Mike and I get a little envious. If the flying ferrets become a global billion-dollar industry, Mike gets insanely rich on common stock, and I'm still stuck here making my mathematically capped 5%. Doesn't feel right. Fiona really needs his capital, so she offers a sweetener. She says, okay, Carl, I have a hybrid solution, participating preferred. You get your absolute guaranteed priority on your 5% fixed dividend. But TT, if we have an absolute blowout, record-breaking year, and our profits exceed a specific predetermined benchmark, you get to participate in the excess upside. We will throw you an extra bonus dividend, effectively sharing some of that massive profit with you alongside the common stockholders.
Apply the golden rule. Who benefits? Carl. He gets the downside protection of the fixed rate PLO US, a taste of the unlimited upside of the common stock. It is literally the best of both worlds.
Result. Because it benefits the investor so heavily, providing a hedge against missing out on massive growth, participating preferred is always issued with a lower stated dividend rate than standard straight preferred.
Next up, convertible preferred. I absolutely love the mechanics of this one. I call this the escape hatch.
In this scenario, Carl is nervous about long-term inflation eroding the purchasing power of his fixed $5 dividend, or maybe he just wants ultimate strategic flexibility.
Right.
So Fiona offers him convertible preferred. She says, Carl, you get your fixed preferred dividend priority, but at any time of your absolute choosing, you have the unilateral right to hand this preferred certificate back to me, and I will tear it up and give you a fixed predetermined number of common shares in exchange.
Let's pause and talk about the exam terminology here because they will test the math. The number of common shares you get when you pull the lever is called the conversion ratio. And the math dictates a conversion price, which is simply the preferred stock's par value divided by that ratio. So if par is $100 and the ratio is 4, the conversion price is $25.
That makes sense.
But let's look at the psychology and strategy of why Carl wants this. Carl holds this preferred share. The fixed dividend is paying his golf fees, keeping him safe. But suddenly, Fiona's company accidentally discovers that ferret dander cures the common cold.
Wow. Huge pivot for the company.
Massive pivot. The common stock price rockets to the moon. It's trading at $200 a share.
Carl doesn't have to sit there sadly collecting his fixed 5% yield while Mike gets rich. He pushes the button. He activates the escape hatch. He converts his preferred shares into common shares, instantly transforming himself from a conservative fixed income investor into a high growth residual equity owner. Mm. And he rides the rocket ship straight up.
He gets a structural safety net with a built-in escape hatch to wealth. Who benefits? Carl, the investor.
Result. Because the conversion feature is incredibly valuable to the investor, providing a definitive link to equity upside. Convertible preferred always, mathematically, has a lower dividend rate than straight preferred.
Okay, take a breath because we are doing a massive 180-degree turn. We are talking about callable preferred. And honestly, looking at it from Carl's perspective, this feature feels like an absolute malicious rug pull.
Let's set the stage carefully to understand the issuer's motivation here. Carl buys a standard preferred stock, paying a very generous 8% dividend. He is absolutely thrilled. 8% is an incredible return for a priority security. He sits back in his recliner, fully expecting to collect that 8% yield for the rest of his natural life. But 5 years later, the macro economy changes drastically. The Federal Reserve aggressively slashes interest rates to stimulate the economy. Now, average market rates for new preferred stock are only 4%.
Fiona is sitting in her CEO office looking at her corporate balance sheet, and she is furious. She says, why in the world am I still bleeding cash paying Carl 8% every year when the current market rate is only 4%? I could issue brand new stock today and cut my capital costs in half. I am wasting corporate funds. Now, if Carl held common stock, she'd be stuck. But this certificate clearly says callable preferred.
The term callable means the issuer, Fiona, retains the unilateral legal right to call or redeem the shares back from Carl at a specified price, usually at or slightly above par value. She literally forces Carl to sell his prized shares back to the company against his will.
She forcibly takes the shares off his hands, hands Carl his original $100 cash back, and immediately turns around and issues new shares to some other investor at the much cheaper 4% rate. She successfully refinanced her equity to save the company money. It's a brilliant corporate finance move for her. But what about Carl?
Carl is absolutely devastated. This specific action creates what the Series 65 explicitly tests as reinvestment risk. Let's look at Carl's reality. He now has his $100 back in cash, but he is living in a new 4% economic world. He goes out to the market looking for a safe 8% return to replace his lost income, and it simply doesn't exist anymore. His personal income just got chopped in half because his highest yielding asset was forcibly called away from him at the exact moment it was most valuable.
Let's apply the golden rule. Who benefits from a call feature? The issuer, Fiona. It gives her massive strategic flexibility to refinance and save money when rates drop. Who gets hurt? The investor. It adds severe reinvestment risk for Carl and caps his potential gains.
And this brings us to the ultimate exam gotcha for this section. Because this callable feature actively hurts the investor and massively benefits the issuer, there is no logical way Carl would ever agree to buy it unless he was heavily, heavily compensated upfront for taking on that looming threat of a rug pull. Therefore, callable preferred must logically be issued with a significantly higher stated dividend rate than standard preferred stock.
Let's run the yield trade-off principle one more time so it sticks. Say it with me. Investor benefits like cumulative arrearages, participating bonuses, or convertible escape hatches equal a lower yield. Issuer benefits, specifically the callable rug pull, equal a higher yield. If you can walk through that logic path in your head, you can answer literally any preferred stock feature question that Tess throws at you without memorizing a single flashcard.
Now, there is one final, unique variation of preferred stock mentioned in the outline. Floating rate, which is sometimes called adjustable rate preferred. This was engineered as a direct structural response to the intense interest rate sensitivity we discussed earlier.
Right, because Carl hates that seesaw effect. He hates looking at his brokerage statement and seeing that when the Federal Reserve raises rates, the principal price of his fixed-rate preferred stock crashes. It stresses him out.
So financial engineers created floating rate, preferred to solve this specific psychological pain point by removing the fixed dividend entirely. Instead of locking in at 5% forever, the dividend rate adjusts periodically, usually resetting every quarter based on a moving benchmark interest rate. The text specifically mentions benchmarks like the Secured Overnight Financing Rate, or SOFR, or a short-term treasury bill rate.
So it moves with the market.
Exactly. The mechanics work like this. The company takes that shifting benchmark rate, adds a fixed contractual spread, let's say, an extra 2%, to compensate for corporate risk, and whatever that math adds up to becomes your dividend payment for that specific quarter.
I want to push back on this, though. If the dividend is constantly changing, how does that help Carl's anxiety? What does this actually do to the underlying price of the stock?
It creates incredible price stability. Think about the seesaw mechanics. If market interest rates suddenly shoot up to a chaotic 10%, Carl's floating rate preferred doesn't crash in price like his fixed rate stock did. Why? Because the dividend simply resets at the end of the quarter and adjusts upward to automatically match the new 10% environment.
Oh, that makes sense.
Because the yield it kicks out is constantly automatically adjusting to remain competitive with the current open market. There's no mathematical reason for the underlying principal price of the stock to fluctuate. The price stays anchored incredibly close to par value.
It virtually eliminates interest rate risk. That is the testable concept right there. It provides principal stability in a volatile rate environment. The trade-off, of course, because there is always a trade-off, is that if rates plummet back down to near zero, your dividend payout plummets right along with them. But for an investor strictly looking to protect their principal price in a shifting rate environment, floating rate is the structural answer.
All right. We have thoroughly mapped out common stock. We have navigated the global variations in ADRs. We have dissected preferred stock and its features. Now, unfortunately, the time has come to enter the final segment of our deep dive.
We are entering the doomsday scenario.
Every corporate journey has a potential end. And for Fiona's flying ferrets, we're going to imagine the absolute catastrophic worst case scenario. The company goes completely and utterly bankrupt. Let's say the ferret glider craze ends abruptly and tragically after a highly publicized multi-ferret mid-air collision during the Super Bowl halftime show.
A PR nightmare.
Total nightmare. The brand is toxic. Sales go to zero overnight. The company has no cash left to make payroll. The creditors have lost patience and forced the company into Chapter 7 liquidation.
The company is legally being dissolved. It's over. A bankruptcy judge steps in and orders every single remaining physical asset the company owns, the ergonomic office furniture, the specialized ferret cages, the aerodynamic goggles, the warehouse real estate to be forcibly auctioned off for cash. We now have a finite, shrinking pile of money sitting on the courthouse steps. And surrounding that single pile of money is a massive, angry mob of people holding contracts, all screaming that Fiona owes them money.
The specific scenario brings us to the concept of capital structure and liquidation priority. The Series 65 exam will absolutely test your knowledge of the exact legal hierarchy of claims. You must know exactly who gets paid first from that pile of money, who gets paid second, and who inevitably gets left holding an empty bag.
Now, earlier we said don't memorize, understand. But this sequence is built on hundreds of years of bankruptcy case law. We are going to walk through this order, and we're going to explain why each person stands where they stand so the logic sticks.
The order of claims, from first to last, is a rigid legal doctrine. Priority number one, at the absolute front of the line, secured creditors. These are the secured bondholders or the commercial banks who issued loans backed by a specific hard collateral.
Let's explain why they are first. They show up to the courthouse and they don't just say, Fiona owes us money. They hold up a contract and say, Fiona took out a $10 million loan to buy the main warehouse. And this legally binding mortgage says if she defaults, we get the deed to the firehouse.
And the judge agrees.
The bankruptcy judge looks at the law and agrees. Their claim is perfected. They get paid first, straight from the cash generated by selling that specific piece of collateral. They have absolute priority.
Moving down the line, we hit priority number two, unsecured creditors. This is a massive bucket. It includes debenture holders, which are bondholders who loan the company money based purely on the company's general creditworthiness without demanding specific collateral.
Right.
It also includes general creditors, which means all the daily operational vendors, the people who supplied the specialized ferret food, the local electric company keeping the lights on, the janitorial services cleaning the cages. They have valid legal contracts proving they are owed money, but they don't have a lien on a specific building. They get to split whatever cash is left in the pile after the secured creditors take their massive cut.
Then we have priority number three, subordinated debenture holders. Now, why are they separate? These are investors who bought a very specific type of junior corporate debt. When they loan Fiona the money, they literally signed a legal subordination agreement explicitly stating, we acknowledge that if the company goes bankrupt, we agree to stand behind the regular unsecured bondholders in the repayment line.
Why would anyone agree to that?
Because Fiona offered them a significantly higher interest rate while times were good to compensate for that exact risk. They rolled the dice for yield, and now they are paying the price. They are third in line, picking at the dwindling pile.
Now, I want you to pause and notice a structural pattern here. We just listed secured creditors, unsecured creditors, and subordinated creditors. What do all three of those groups fundamentally have in common legally?
They're all lenders. They hold debt. None of them are owners.
Exactly. Which brings us to the ultimate foundational exam rule for liquidation scenarios. All debt is paid before ANY equity. The test writers will try to confuse you by mixing up bondholders and stockholders in a multiple choice list and asking you to rank them. The fundamental, unshakable rule of corporate finance law is that external lenders must have their capital returned before the internal owners are allowed to extract a single dime from the failing enterprise.
Which finally leads us to priority number four, preferred stockholders.
Enter conservative Carl. He steps up to the courthouse steps. He is legally an owner, not a lender. But remember his identity crisis. Remember his preference. This is the exact moment that preference pays off. Because he holds preferred equity, the corporate charter grants him the legal right to stand in front of the common equity. If by some miracle there is any money left in the pile after the massive mountain of secured, unsecured, and subordinated debt has been entirely satisfied, Carl gets his original $100 par value investment returned to him.
And finally, we reach priority number five, the absolute dead last position in the entire capital structure.
Minority shareholder, Mike. Yep. The common stockholders. The ultimate residual claimants.
Let's paint a realistic picture of this. Mike has been waiting at the very back of the buffet line all day. He watches the secured banks take millions to satisfy the mortgages. He watches the ferret food vendors get cut checks. He watches the subordinated debt holders take a haircut but still walk away with something. He watches conservative Carl scrape the bottom of the barrel to get his par value back. By the time the bankruptcy judge finally looks over at Mike, the pile of cash is almost always completely 100% gone.
Yeah, it's brutal.
Think about historical examples like the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy in 2008. Billions of dollars in assets completely evaporated. The common stockholders were utterly wiped out.
In a true real-world corporate liquidation scenario, The common stockholders generally receive absolutely nothing. The value of their residual claim is zero.
But to bring this entire deep dive full circle and end on a note of protection, let's remember where we started. Even though Mike loses his entire investment and his shares go to zero because of the legal doctrine of limited liability, the angry bankruptcy judge cannot order Mike to open his personal wallet to pay off the electric company's remaining unpaid bills.
The corporate veil holds.
Exactly. His total financial loss is permanently capped at the money he used to buy those original 100 shares.
That structural hierarchy? Secured debt, unsecured debt, subordinated debt, preferred stock, and common stock at the dead bottom is non-negotiable on the Series 65 exam. You must understand the logic of why the line is ordered that way.
Okay, we have covered an incredible amount of technical ground today, from the buffet line of residual claims to the magic window of ADRs. To make sure these concepts are firmly locked in for test day, let's hit a rapid-fire recap. We're going to volley the top five most highly testable takeaways from this deep dive. Hit me with number one.
Takeaway one, voting mechanics. Statutory voting mathematically benefits the majority shareholder. Cumulative voting mathematically benefits the minority shareholder by allowing them to pool and concentrate their votes on a single board seat.
Takeaway two, ADRs and currency risk. American depositary receipts trade in U.S. dollars and deposit dividends into your account in U.S. dollars, but they do not eliminate currency risk because the actual underlying equity asset is still sitting in a foreign vault priced in a foreign currency.
Takeaway three, preferred stock behavior. It suffers an identity crisis. It is equity that acts like a fixed income bond. It's highly sensitive to interest rates. If market rates go up, the price of existing preferred stock goes down. And investors generally trade away their voting rights in exchange for absolute dividend priority.
Takeaway four, the yield trade-off principle. When analyzing preferred stock features, look at who benefits. If a special feature benefits the investor, like cumulative arrearages or convertible escape hatch, the yield is structurally lower. If the feature benefits the issuer, like a callable rug pull, the yield must be higher to compensate the investor for the added risk.
Takeaway five, liquidation priority. The golden rule is all debt before any equity. The order is secured creditors, unsecured creditors, subordinated debt, preferred stock, and common stock is always dead last, holding the residual bag.
Fantastic. We have thoroughly dismantled the mechanics of the equity securities section. But before we sign off, part of our goal here is to make you think like a true financial analyst, not just a test taker. So we have one final provocative thought for you to chew on regarding these concepts. Something to mull over while you take your cert field practice exams this week.
Yeah, I want you to think deeply about the macro implications of convertible preferred stock. We spent our time talking about it as a neat little safety net with the jolt-in escape hatch for conservative Carl.
Mm.
But shift your perspective and think about the terrifying implications for founder Fiona.
Oh, this is good.
Right. As an investor, Carl holds a contractual mechanism that allows him to unilaterally shift the company's entire capital structure with the push of a button. He can magically transform himself from a preferred priority shareholder into a voting common residual owner. Now ask yourself this. If Fiona's company is executing flawlessly, the stock price skyrockets, and suddenly every single preferred institutional investor realizes it's mathematically advantageous to convert at exactly the same time what happens to the voting power and control of the original founders when hundreds of thousands of brand new voting common shares suddenly poof into existence out of thin air.
Oh man, the dilution of control is staggering. The founders could theoretically execute their business plan perfectly, build a wildly successful company, and literally lose control of their own boardroom just because they were too successful and triggered mass conversion.
It's crazy.
It is a brilliant, terrifying, double-edged sword of corporate finance. Listeners, if you can apply that kind of deep mechanical logic to your studying, seeing how all these gears connect to one another, you are going to absolutely crush the Series 65. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the corporate buffet line. Keep thinking critically, keep questioning the underlying mechanisms, and we will see you on the next one.